Hello, this is Katie Day with Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women over 50 across the globe. You don't have to be a Mother Teresa to make an impact on the world. Sometimes the small acts and achievements can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure and honour to be interviewing Baroness Caroline Cox. Baroness Cox was created a life peer in 1982 and was a deputy speaker of the House of Lords from 1985 to 2005. She was founder chancellor of Bournemouth University in the southwest of England, chancellor of Liverpool Hope University from 2006 to 2013, and is an honourable vice president of the Royal College of Nursing. She's also chief executive of HEART, Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust. Caroline has been awarded the Commander Cross of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Poland, the Wilberforce Award, the International Mother Teresa Award from the All India Christian Council, the Mikhtar Ghosh Medal conferred by the Republic of Armenia, and the Anniversary Medal presented by Lech Walesa. She has been awarded an Honorary Fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons of England and Honorary Doctorates by universities in the United Kingdom, the United States of America, the Russian Federation and Armenia. Her humanitarian work takes her to conflict and post-conflict zones, including the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, Sudan, South Sudan, Nigeria, Uganda and Burma. She has visited North Korea to promote parliamentary initiatives and communities suffering from conflict in Indonesia. Caroline, thank you so much. I'm aware of your completely bonkers schedule, so the fact that you've given me time to speak is phenomenal. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
I've been reading up about HEART and looking at your website and looking at your annual report. The work that you do is absolutely incredible. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to be involved?
Well, thank you. When I introduce myself, all I say about myself is I'm a nurse and a social scientist by intention. That's what I thought I was doing my life. A baroness by astonishment, because I was not into politics, and you become a baroness by being appointed to the British House of Lords, which is equivalent to the Senate and other forms of parliaments. And I was not in that world, so much so that I was actually the first baroness I'd ever met.
Oh my gosh!
I've met one in my life before. I didn't move in those circles. You wake up one morning and find a baroness looking at yourself out of the bathroom mirror. Quite a shock. So you say, how can I use this privilege of being able to speak in one of the houses of the British Parliament? And the idea came that it's a wonderful place to be a voice for those who don't have a voice. Right. Be a voice for the voiceless.
Right.
So that's how I've tried to use it. In the early days, for example, I supported legislation to outlaw female genital mutilation in this country. More recently, I established this small charity or not-for-profit organisation, HEART, to work for victims of oppression and persecution who are largely off the radar screen of the major media and not being reached by major aid organisations.
Right.
Because the big organisations, the names you all know, like the UN, Red Cross and so on, can only go places with the permission of a sovereign government.
Right.
If a sovereign government is victimising a minority in its own borders, doesn't give permission to those aid organisations to go, they don't go. So the victims are left unreached, unhelped, unheard. So in HEART we spend quite a lot of our time crossing borders illegally and completely shamelessly to take aid and advocacy to those victims of oppression and persecution.
You must have put yourself in some very interesting situations as a result of this. How have you managed that?
Well, sometimes it's obviously dangerous. You go into war zones, and clearly bombs are no reflector of persons, or if they were, they'd probably target me directly. But we go with the local people, and they are heroes and heroines on front lines of faith and freedom around the world. We're a Christian organisation, but we don't only work for Christians. Christian mandate is to heal the sick and speak for the oppressed, not just the Christian sick, the Christian oppressed. It happens that most people suffering persecution in the world today are Christians. So most of our work is with the persecuted church, but it's also our privilege to work, for example, with our Buddhist colleagues in Burma, in Shan State, with Muslims in Blue Nile State, in Sudan, who are suffering horrendously. But to be there with unconditional aid and advocacy. But the real heroes and heroines are our partners, because you work through local partners on the ground, and they make transformational changes for their own people.
Well, you mentioned the fact that the established, if you like, aid agencies like, you know, the UN, the Red Cross, etc., who have to go in through the legal route. How did you identify the partners? If you didn't have the ability to go in there under in normal circumstances, how were you able to identify the right partners to work with?
Good question. Well, by definition, if you are a people suffering oppression and persecution, you're going to have a diaspora. You're going to have people in exile.
Right.
And we are approached by people who've had to flee their country or are representing their country and come to us and say, please, please, will you help my people? Right. For example, with the Armenians, I did a lot of work, as may have been clear in what you said in the introduction, earlier in the days of the Soviet Union, in Poland and in Russia. I was asked to help chair the first genuine independent human rights conference in Moscow by a famous human rights activist, Yelena Bona Sakharov, the widow of the famous Andrei Sakharov. And while I was chairing one of those sessions, a representative from the place no one's ever heard of, me included, called Nagorno-Karabakh, then said, while you people are suffering, or you're talking about human rights, my people are suffering them. And Azerbaijan has just begun ethnic cleansing of the Armenians from this little land that Stalin cut off from Armenia and put inside Azerbaijan. And Operation Ring had begun with this systematic encirclement and brutal deportation of Armenians from these villages. So I was asked to lead a delegation down to the area to investigate, and trying to follow in the footsteps of Andrei Sakharov, we try always to be on the side of the victim. So we made quite sure that in these situations where we work, our partners are indeed victims of oppressive regimes. And then we get alongside them, we ask them their priorities for aid and advocacy. I've since been to Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh 83 times. But I've also been to other countries, Burma probably at least 50 times, Sudan and South Sudan many, many times during the previous war, and now currently Northern Nigeria, where people are suffering so much, of course, from Boko Haram now. So people approach us and we go and visit to make quite sure, A, that they are the oppressed and genuine persecuted people and not aggressors. And secondly, to ask their priorities, and then to find, introduce to one of their leaders whom they respect, who is a community leader, to be our partner, and to help them make change for their own communities in very challenging situations.
With your work there, working with these partners in these areas across the world, have you been able to, and the fact that you're not working with the governments because you kind of go in through the back door, so to speak, have you been able to influence the governments in any way with the work that you do to create better conditions in these countries?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. We're doing quite a lot of work with partners in Burma, or Myanmar, but the local people prefer the word Burma. And there is still fighting going on, in particularly with the ethnic national peoples, the Kachin, predominantly Christian, the Shan, predominantly Buddhist, the Rohingya, predominantly Muslim. But we also have a program in Chin State, which was very much under oppression, but now has a much more liberal policy, thanks to a much more liberal chief minister of Chin State. And I think there we've been able to support reform in Chin State. And there is now a program, an amazing program, of training community health workers for villages who had no healthcare whatever. And we have an amazing partner there, Dr. Sasser, as he's known, and he's now trained 800 community health workers, providing healthcare in over 400 villages. And those health workers save the lives of 8 out of 10 people who would previously have died.
I was reading about that in your report. It's phenomenal.
I mean, the multiplier effect, the mustard seed effect, is phenomenal. And there we have very good relationships, and we do encourage reform there, and particularly there's no more forced labour there. There are much better relations between the army and the police with the local people. So there, that is a positive story.
Okay.
Other countries like Azerbaijan, where Stalin located this ancient piece of Armenia, called Nagorno-Karabakh, in his divide and rule tactics, and where Azerbaijan began the ethnic cleansing attempted of the Armenians, and that bitter war broke out in the early 90s. And we went there many times with humanitarian aid. A ceasefire was eventually signed, and it's held, it's very precarious. But our aid has changed from emergency medical aid to a rehabilitation centre, which is innovative and inspirational, because the former Soviet Union had no concept of rehabilitation for people with disabilities.
Right.
And it's state-of-the-art rehabilitation centre, giving the best possible quality of life for people with disabilities, but not only in Karabakh, spreading throughout the South Caucasus.
Mm.
Wonderful.
Mm.
But Azerbaijan still does not pursue any peace policies as far as Nagorno-Karabakh is concerned. The government, I'm afraid, is full of very hostile propaganda, threatening another war to solve the Karabakh problem. So it's a very volatile and a very unhappy situation from the point of view of Azerbaijan's policy of very belligerent propaganda. And they don't really like me very much. In fact, when I came out of one of the visits in Karabakh a couple of years ago, I went to the Armenian embassy in Armenia and Yerevan, and they had a copy of an Azerbaijan newspaper with an article with a large heading saying, "Shoot the cocks." And
oh
then
my
it went
gosh.
On, "Cox only visits Nagorno-Karabakh to look after her heroin crops."
It's
the only way she can raise money for her work.
Oh my goodness.
At that time, it had a couple of very good friends who were staying back to go with the wonderful head of the mountain rescue team in Karabakh. They love nature and flora and fauna. And I said, "Please find my heroin fields." But I haven't found them yet.
But yeah, I mean, we're laughing at the absurdity of that headline. But the scary thing is people buy into that kind of propaganda, don't they? So, that creates, or I can imagine it can create even more challenges for you to get people on side who may choose to, because there's an element of brainwashing, isn't there, with that kind of propaganda, with that kind of headline. So to actually to convince the people when you can't be there permanently, so you're kind of going in, coming out, to have that consistency of trust. Do you find that is challenging to build up that consistency of trust, or when you find the right partners, it's easy to establish?
When you find the right partners, it's very easy to establish. People have huge admiration for the work that's being done in these very difficult situations in the jungles of Burma, in the remote, unrecognised land of Nagorno-Karabakh, but other work we do in Nigeria and Sudan and South Sudan and so on. I don't find any sign of compassion fatigue. I think people have huge respect on the achievements we can report, because we go and visit and we bring first-hand reports of what people are doing in these very difficult conditions. And I find people are immensely generous. I think they're healthily sceptical, sometimes, of the really big aid organisations, where you know I did quite where your money goes, and a lot may go on bureaucracy and a lot may not reach the people it's intended for. But because any donations and any money from heart goes direct to local partners, goes through no middle people whatever, and our partners have these phenomenal achievements, then we find people are very generous. On the advocacy side, it varies. As I say, I hope in Burma we can have a positive influence, encouraging reform where we find it, but we still have to speak out critically where we find violations of human rights continuing. And sometimes it's really hurtful. For example, I came out of Karabakh during the war with Azerbaijan, and I had photographs of kids absolutely shredded by cluster bombs, which Azerbaijan was using against the Armenian civilians. Now, that's against all international conventions. Well, I raised that with the British Minister of State and said, would the British government make representations to the government of Azerbaijan to stop dropping cluster bombs on children? It is against all international conventions. And the answer I received was actually very painful. All I was told was, no country has an interest in other countries, only interests, sir. And we have oil interests in Azerbaijan. Good morning. Well, I was shattered. I actually did report that on the floor of the House of Lords. I didn't get the name of the minister because it was an unofficial briefing. But I actually said, for the first time in my life, I'm ashamed to be British.
Gosh.
I'm not naive. I can understand commercial interests. I can understand strategic interests. But I don't think it's in the long-term interest of any nation to let those override concern for human rights. And I don't think the majority of British people would want oil at the price of cluster bombs on children, at least without saying something about it. But I think the kind of work we do, that's sometimes the double twist of the knife. You are there with the people, with the raw suffering. You feel the anguish of being alongside them and seeing their suffering. You come back and you can go to the official organisations, parliament, other places, and seek advocacy to try to affect the policies being perpetrated by the aggressors. And then you find other interests take over, so you feel you're crying into the wind. But we still do it, because sometimes it may have an effect. And ultimately, the truth has got to be on the record. If it doesn't have an immediate impact, then at least it is on the record and can be there to be used as appropriate in due course.
We all have a responsibility, don't we? My belief is we all have a responsibility with the gift of life that we've all been given to use it to the best of our ability, and to look internally at our own moral compass just to see which direction it's pointing, and to make any adjustments in the course should we need to. Have you ever been in a position where you've been able to walk away from a country because you feel your work is done?
Yes, I'm happy to say we have. But before Heart was born, but in the kind of work that we do, one of my happiest days was in Poland. After being many, many times to Poland with medical aid during the dark years of martial law, when the Polish people were really suffering. And then Poland emerged into freedom and democracy. And we went back with more medical aid because we knew there would still be nothing in the clinics and nothing in the hospitals. A month after their freedom was achieved and they'd had democratic elections, and I was invited to the Polish parliament, one of the happiest days of my life.
What was it?
And here were parliamentarians democratically elected in a democratic government, whom I'd met previously in and out of prison and hiding in ploughed fields away from the bugging devices. And the chairman of the parliament was very gracious and just said, "We invited you here to say thank you for sharing our darkness." And that was a very happy day.
Yeah.
More recently, in the kind of areas Heart is now working, we worked very hard in South Sudan. And then when the peace agreement was signed, the situation changed from emergency aid and advocacy in redeeming slaves, we redeemed many, many slaves, to working with people now in their own independent country. Still has many problems, but one of our wonderful partners, the Bishop Elias Taban, down in Yei, been big city, one of the epicentres of fighting. We were with him in the early days of independence, and we gave him, and you can give small amounts, because Heart is tiny. It's only 4.5 of us in Heart, UK. Very small. But he said, you know, what you give us can be absolutely transformational, and it was. And then we had a lovely day when a lot of the programmes we'd helped with had established his reputation. He went over to States and he was able to show his portfolio of achievements. And then he got big funding. Wow. And he wrote to us and said, "Thank you so much. I now have a lot of support from official sources. I no longer need what you have to offer. Please use it for other people. But I couldn't have got where I did without what Heart made possible."
Yeah.
And that's very exciting.
Incredibly moving and humbling as well. I think when you have that. I was really interested reading through about India. And I underlined this particular sentence because it leapt out at me. Called for the inclusion of amendments. This is about the Global Slavery Index. That would directly address slavery in international supply chains. And that leapt out at me because I was in India early this year, and I'm going in 2 days' time for a business trip to Mumbai. And I know that corporate social responsibility is a very big issue in India at the moment. What I'm noticing is that they confuse philanthropy with corporate social responsibility, and the two, philanthropy is part of it, but it's not it. And I was interested to know, because part of inclusive CSR is looking at supply chain, of can you impact...
Sorry. I'm running out of time. Are we nearly through our 25 minutes? Sorry.
Six. Have you been able to have any impact with the... Or do you think you could with the Indian government around looking at this, the slavery issue, as part of their corporate social responsibility?
Well, there's two, I think, important answers to that important question. The first is that we've just passed the Modern Slavery Act in the British Parliament, and I was very supportive of the amendments which tried to address slavery down the supply chains of large international corporations. So that is a very key issue, and that relates not just to India, but to anywhere where big businesses may well have slavery or forced labour or something somewhere in their supply chain. So that I'm 100% on side, supported, and think is very important. Other issues in India, which we're more directly involved with, for example, such as the situation with the Dalits or the Untouchables, or the Devadasi, the women and girls who are given to temple prostitution at a young age and suffer horrendously. We've asked our partners out there, who are Indian partners, whether we should do anything in the field of advocacy here. And they say, no, please, this is an Indian issue that is much better dealt with by Indians for Indians. We are working on this. Federal law has already been changed. It's got to be put into effect locally. But this is a matter for Indians to do with for Indians. And that's where it's really important. We listen to local people. Yeah. We don't interfere inappropriately.
Yeah.
That where it's appropriate, we do all we can.
Yeah.
But really important to have the humility, I think, to respect the dignity of our partners and not to go crashing in, either with aid or advocacy. That's not their priority, but always to ask your priority for aid, ask your priority for advocacy, and then listen to them.
Listen.
We're there to serve.
It's really important, isn't it? Because I have an issue with certain parts of, you know, the bigger organisations, which I think are really, they represent the arrogance of the West sometimes, and it's really important actually to do exactly what you do, to ask the question and to hear and understand and then respond appropriately. Final question, Caroline, because I know your time is pushed, and thank you so much. Just one question. Do you ever see a time in the future when heart won't be needed, or do you think conflict is part of the human condition?
Well, I would love to see a time when heart is no longer needed, but if you look back over centuries of history, do you find any year when there's been no conflict,
no
oppression, no persecution? If human nature can change, if what I would regard very often as evil, and I think some of the witness, some of the situations which you witness can be characterised genuinely as evil, if we can eradicate evil from the human phenomenon, then heart wouldn't be necessary. But while unfortunately victims suffer from oppressive and brutal regimes and persecution, then heart is needed. I would just briefly say that there are other aid organisations for the big catastrophes, like earthquakes, tsunamis and so on. They will always be needed. Heart doesn't work there because that's where the big teams are needed, your surgical teams or engineers. But we do work with the forgotten people in the forgotten land, but other people are not. And as I say, for victims of oppression and persecution, and while oppression continues as part of the human phenomenon, then I'm afraid heart will be needed, but we need to grow. We're tiny. We have a very small organisation, 4.5 in the UK. I'm a half home team people. And we do everything out of a very small office, like something out of Charles Dickens. We want as much money as possible to go out to our partners.
Absolutely.
We have a 501c3 in the States, which we're hoping to nurture and to grow. We do need to grow to provide more aid and more advocacy for people for whom we would love to do more.
How can people get in touch with you and find out more about Heart?
Well, we have our website, www.heart-uk.org, and that will tell anyone anything they want to know.
And that's H-A-R-T.
H-A-R-T, Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust. We also have a heart with an E, part of our logo, but our name is Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, or Heart.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Such an inspiring story, and so unfortunately you are very desperately needed in the world. It's sad that you are, but you are, and thank God for you.
Well, thank you for letting me share a little bit of the pain and the passion and the privilege of making a difference.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Katie Day, the High Heeled Leader, with Creating Ripples, the programme where women over 50 are showcased as the fabulous, amazing and awesome human beings we are. Coming up in future weeks, we have many more wonderful and inspiring women with their unique stories. Make sure you tune in, feel inspired, and start thinking about how you create your own ripples in life. Thank you for listening.
You can also tell them that I'm well over 50, I'm 78.
And looks about 40.